yourselves.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Members of the Lake Washington School District community are posting online about their shock over the detainment of Fernando Rocha, Juanita High School's theater manager. Rocha is listed on the school's performing arts page as a very important part of that arts program.
That is the way that Fox 13 News out of Seattle is reporting what I consider a very significant story. It is the story, and even though most of the media is not telling it this way, of an illegal alien teacher at Lake Washington School District who is a wanted alleged criminal from Brazil who came to America on a tourist visa. I suspect that saying it was a tourist visa was a lie because you're saying, I just want to come and visit your country, when in fact, the man wanted to come and stay. And he came on a tourist visa and then overstayed for the last 7 years, and then he claimed asylum. And I'll tell you how that scam works in just a moment. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to have you with me on a Wednesday. Welcome to the Radio Northwest Network as well, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. If you want to send me an email, it's talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you'd like to join the conversation, that's easy. 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Also, you can answer our X poll. Should the government check your personal data that you submitted to get food stamps to confirm that you're actually eligible for those benefits? You can find the X poll question at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. But I want to turn back to the man known as Fernando Rocha, theater manager at Juanita High School in Kirkland, Washington, very prosperous community. And I want you to consider this. We have been told for decades that the only reason that illegal aliens come here is because they're doing the jobs that Americans don't want to do. Do you suppose that there are a few Americans, not the ones who want to go out and work in a field or pick crops, but that might want to be a well-paid, full salary and benefits and a pension from a state-run school and be able to be the theater manager at that school? I suspect that there are more than a few Americans who would love to have that job. And yet, as the theater manager, he was arrested by United States Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. First reported by our friend Jonathan Cho, it happened on Sunday, the 20th, so just 13 days ago. And he had been working there for some number of years. We can't find out all the details, although I did reach out to the Lake Washington School District. They're not saying much about this, except they say all of our employees have to fill out an I-9. So how is it that this guy has a job? Well, it appears that this is the way the scam works. And I call it a scam, but it's a scam within the rules of the federal government. They say, if you want to come to America, you immigrate legally. If you want to come and visit, you can come on a tourist visa. He came on a tourist visa. Now, can I reach into the guy's head and tell whether or not the man was intending to just come on a tourist visa and then ignore the end date on that visa? I can't. I can't tell you that. What I can tell you is he came here in 2018 and then he never went home as his tourist visa required him to do. And then at some point over the last 8 years, 7 years, Fernando Rocha filed for asylum. Now, that might strike you as a bit strange when you find out that Fernando Rocha is from Brazil. And you wonder, well, hold on, what's he claiming asylum for? You can't claim asylum just because you say, my country is kind of a crap hole, and I'd like to come to America because it's much nicer. I can get a better paying job. That doesn't get you asylum. What you get asylum for under U.S. law is if you are fleeing a civil war, if you're fleeing some kind of civil disruption that's going on in your country, not Brazil. Brazil may be corrupt, but they don't have the kind of problems that places like Venezuela does. So What is the other thing that federal law in America and international law says? It says that if you are fleeing as an asylee, it says you can go, but then you have to stop. You can seek asylum in the first safe country that you come to. Well, just take a look at a map. Brazil is in South America. There are about a dozen countries between Brazil and the United States of America. Now, you might say, well, none of those countries is as nice as the United States of America. And I think you'd be absolutely right about that. Could he have gone to Ecuador? Could he have gone to any of the other countries that surround Brazil? He could have. But I think what he wanted to do was come to the United States, and he did. And then he may well have known when he applied for asylum, the immigration courts in America and the immigration system is so jammed up with illegal aliens, especially the 10 million that came over the last 4 years during open borders, Joe Biden's tenure as president or whatever he was doing while he sat in the Oval Office, and somebody else used the auto pen a million times, literally a million times, to sign documents that were allegedly signed with Joe Biden's acquiescence and sign off. Well, so what happens when you have a jammed up asylum system? It means you can file an asylum claim. And then if you don't get action on your claim within 150 days, and by the way, I appreciate the help from some of my immigration attorney friends who point that out. You apply for asylum. You don't get a hearing within 150 days. You can immediately get a work permit. Now, are you likely to be denied your asylum claim? Sure. But when's your case going to actually come up before the immigration courts? Could be a decade, could be longer, might never happen at all, depending on who is running the federal government at that point. Under Joe Biden didn't have a problem with a jammed up immigration system because it benefited him. It benefited him, and the Democrats thought it would benefit them as well. After all, you've got a brand new crop of likely Democrat voters who are going to remember who helped them get into the country. So what's happening now? State Senator Manka Dhingra, she's out there saying, well, he's here legally. Legally, sort of, in that his claim for asylum has not been judged by the courts. And he doesn't appear, I think, based on the facts, to have a legitimate claim for asylum. But until a court decides that, he is technically legally in the country. And he's working at the kind of job that many Americans who seek a job in education would probably love to have. Come in on a tourist visa, apply for asylum, and know that your pending asylum claim can just sit there, oozing through the federal immigration courts, never actually getting to a judge, never actually getting decided. Or by the time it does, you know what we're going to hear? The sad, sad story from all the major media, the cartel media, are going to say, oh, this poor guy, why, he's been here 10 years. Yeah, but he never had a legitimate asylum claim to begin with. And then the fact that apparently Mr. Rocha is wanted on criminal charges from Brazil. Does it bother you a little bit that the Lake Washington School District, and I called the superintendent's office, called their spokespeople and said, I'd love to have you come on and explain, how are you protecting kids when you have somebody on your staff who is a wanted, alleged criminal from another country who's here on a tenuous asylum claim? They indicated they had no interest in coming on to talk about that particular subject. Glad to be with you and glad to take your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Coming up in the Northwest Nonsense, Kabuki Governor Tina Kotek and her fake scam to raise your taxes. If you're a
What does Lars think about smoking the devil's lettuce?
I won't go schizo, will I?
It's a distinct possibility.
Now it's time to take a hit of Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Governor Tina Kotek sure knows how to stage some dramatic political theater. Even her own Democrat Party could not muster up the votes to pass a record-sized tax increase of $15 billion last month. Supermajority Democrats who had the votes to do it even turned down a $2 billion alternative. Get the picture? Even the Democrats are voting against tax increases. And then the governor's show began. State agencies began announcing all kinds of crazy stuff. Hundreds of state employees got layoff notices. All of them, of course, the blue-collar folks on the ground who actually get the work done, and none of the well-paid paper pushers upstairs. Citizens got threats. We won't plow snow in the winter. We won't fill your potholes. A 27% cut in TriMet bus service. All of it designed to scare the daylights out of taxpayers, and all of it 100% fake. How do I know that Tina Kotek is faking? After weeks of sky-is-falling reports by cooperative media, the governor announces she's calling a special session. Layoffs that were set to go into effect 8 days from now are now pushed back a full month. And that special session 5 weeks from now will start on the Friday leading into Labor Day weekend, when they know that most average citizens will not be paying attention. In my book, sleazy tactics, even for a governor who actually won her office using stolen illegal campaign cash. Just call her Kabuki Kotek. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day is brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Why isn't this program being shut down right now? Our friends at Willamette described Oregon's preschool promise program. Yep, that's the one that Kotek is touting as an alternative to the Multnomah County Preschool for All. It awarded hundreds of thousands of dollars to preschool providers that enrolled as few as one or two children. How do I know that? Because the Secretary of State did an investigation, and they released that investigation this morning. As the investigation showed, quote, these funds could have provided child care for 100 additional children instead of the approximately 13 kids that actually got service. Well, and that's the program the governor says is an alternative to preschool for all. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you
ridiculous?
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to all the folks out there today who are saying they're objecting to the idea. They say why Donald Trump is demanding personal data from people in the Northwest. And what do they mean by personal data? Well, what they mean is when somebody goes to the welfare office and they sign up for welfare, for food stamps, for Medicaid, for Section 8, for all that, they turn over their name, their Social Security number, date of birth, other identifying data. Do you know what happens to your personal data, which is your personal data, when you decide to go to a government office to obtain a government taxpayer-funded benefit and you have to show that you qualify? Your personal data ain't personal anymore. It belongs to that government agency. And then when ICE comes in under Donald Trump's direction and says, hey, why don't we check and make sure that all the people who are getting food stamps, welfare, Section 8, Medicaid, etc., that they're all qualified? What if they're not legally in the country? Then they're not qualified. They shouldn't be getting the money. Who should that money be going to? That should be going to the people who are actually qualified to get it, American citizens, green card holders, and otherwise legal aliens. So, pro tip, when you hand over your personal data to a government agency to obtain a taxpayer-funded benefit, it ceases to be personal and you've got no complaint. Our best email of the day, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. I know, I've done it myself. They did it for me, and it's beautiful. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or 855-CAP-THAT. I'm going to leave this one unsigned. Lars, Why are there two log loading operations on the Columbia River that load unprocessed logs on barges every day to ship to China? Bingen and Dallas Port, they've done this for 30 years. We shouldn't be letting whole trees go out of this country completely unprocessed. It costs us homeland jobs, and we buy back their garbage at 1,000% markup. That is bullshit. I said ship. By the way, I'm careful about that. I can give you an answer for that. It's the best deal in the world. Do you know what happens when you cut down a tree in Oregon or Washington and then you replant it? You get a brand new tree. Takes about 50 years, but we're cutting nowhere near sustained yield. We could cut at this rate forever and never run out of trees. So if the Chai comes want to buy unprocessed trees, that is a moneymaker all day long, and it involves selling one of the most renewable resources in the world. What's not to like about that? To your calls now at 866-HEY-LARS. Let me start with Jeff. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, I wanted to talk about the whole freaking stealing the election thing. And
yeah, about Obama?
It's been, yeah, Obama stealing the damn election. Now, if this is absolutely true, which I believe it was true all along, but they prove it's true, and they prove it to the point that you know, it is legally a court-proved thing, then I don't think they should just let this go. I hear talk about this being an immunity thing because he could have been so-called doing stuff under the official acts of the president, which is just a bunch of baloney.
Well, it's not baloney. Jeff, understand it this way. There is immunity for almost every public official in America if they are acting within the scope of their job. So if a cop in Alaska, I take it you probably live in Anchorage or Fairbanks?
Soldovia.
Okay. So if a cop in your town is confronting a man who's presenting a threat and he shoots him to death, is the cop prosecuted?
Shouldn't be.
No, because
they'll do an investigation on the shooting. Like,
yeah, they'll do an investigation, but if he's acting within the scope of his duties, it's his job to shoot dangerous people when necessary to eliminate a threat. Now, if the cop says, hey, I've got immunity, I'm going to go rob a bank, does he get immunity for robbing a bank just because he's wearing a uniform?
Well, here's a better one. If that cop is running for sheriff and he goes and shoots the other guy who's running for sheriff so he can't run against him.
That's murder.
To try and steal the election.
He does not get immunity. So if Obama was acting within the scope of his job as president, but the problem is the evidence that they've released in the last 2 days indicates that Obama knew that Russia was not messing with our elections. His own intelligence agencies told him so explicitly. They said, if anything, Putin is holding back because he sees Hillary Clinton as inevitable. And if he releases all the damning stuff that he's got on Hillary Clinton, that when she becomes president, she's going to take it out on him. So he decided to hold it back. Obama knew that. He deliberately lied to the American public to affect the outcome of an election, and he supported the false hoax that Donald Trump was in league with Russia. Obama should go to jail for that, and I hope he does.
The Lars Larson Show. Facebook, X, and Google may censor you, but you'll never find censorship here.
Don't censor me!
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. But are embattled Republicans in the Northwest now facing a scandal in one congressional district in Oregon over fundraising because of one man? Well, Aaron Mesh is one man, but he's not the guy who got the money. He is the managing editor at Willamette Week. You can find the story at WWeek.com. Aaron, welcome back.
It's good to be here, Lars. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you could stand in for Nigel. But I read this whole story. This is so disappointing. You've got Don Powers, and help me. I want my audience to understand what went on here. He's been a guy who served as the chair of the 6th Congressional District Republicans, and he said, hey, the inauguration is January 20th in D.C. We're going to have a big party. We're going to raise a bunch of money for the party. And a bunch of money came in, over $100,000. And then the money went into his pocket. And I think we can literally say that, can't we? Because he said, rather than put it into the campaign account in the bank, put it in my personal account. I'll take care of everything and we'll get this, we'll get it all done right. and then the money just disappeared. Am I wrong on that one?
They're certainly correct that the money disappeared. Whether it eventually is currently in his, well, actually, it, you are correct also that, that Mr. Powers instructed, donors to sponsors of the event. And this is an inauguration. Let me back up and say this is an inauguration event held for President Trump's inauguration at a very nice hotel. Yeah, venue in Washington, D.C., two blocks from the White House. Roger Stone was there. It was a nice shindig in January to benefit the 6th congressional district Republicans. And it's a purple district in Oregon that Andreas Salinas has won a few times, but certainly it's winnable for Republicans. It's a 5.1 voter registration advantage for Democrats, but that's certainly not insurmountable. We've seen Lori Chavez, the Reamer, overcome far worse odds. So at any rate, there's good reason why you'd want to raise some money for that. And then he told sponsors of the event to route the money to his personal account. It might have been $120,000. It might have been $180,000. Somewhere in that range. The money is now AWOL.
And in fact, this is a guy who's had his share of financial problems that are also documented in the story. He has a lighting company. The lighting company's been around for a while, but with one big client, I think it was, is it Roseboro Forest Products or Roseburg Forest Products?
It is. And that's not a company that you want to trifle with if you are interested in becoming a player in Oregon Republican politics. Roseburg Forest Products down in Douglas County is one of the biggest political donors in the state, mostly to Republicans. Obviously, it has great concerns over forest practices, timber practices in the state, and its bottom line depends on the timber industry, and it has largely bankrolled Republican candidates. And his company, Donald Powers' company, which is called Northwest LED Lights, submitted what Roseburg Forest Products says is a fraudulent claim for $129,000, and he wrote in court records that he is not able to pay it back.
Because the company is now Banco, and just so people understand, the fraudulent claim, as I understand it, Aaron, he goes and does a lighting project for Roseburg Forest Products, and then he goes to the State of Oregon Energy Trust of Oregon, one of those outfits that will give you, you know, a rebate if you've done certain kinds of energy efficiency things, and he makes the, you know, he applies for that benefit. The benefit was supposed to go to the customer who got the lighting and paid for the lighting. Instead, it went into his company, which is now, according to him, financially defunct, right?
That is correct. So, again, without casting aspersions that I can't cast, he certainly was having financial difficulty before he became the host of this inaugural party. Nigel, on behalf of the Oregon Journalism Project, spoke to a number of high-ranking Republicans, including Bill Currier, who was the Republican state chair for 6 years, who says, and this is Bill's quote, quite frankly, this looks like criminal activity.
Yep.
So this is obviously a problem. It's something that the Oregon GOP will want to deal with as quickly as possible and try to clean house if they can.
Well, and you know the thing I'm anticipating, Aaron, because I'll call it out when it happens. I would imagine that the DOJ under Tina Kotek and the new attorney general, who seems more concerned about Donald Trump than he does about Oregon, they'll probably go after this guy hammer and tong if they think he's violated the law. And if he has, they should. But the irony will be that Dan Rayfield, the new AG, who's a Democrat, is going to ignore the financial crimes of people like Tina Kotek and the Democrat Party of Oregon and a few of Val Hoyle and a few others, where I think there was criminal activity, and Shamia Fagan as well. But he'll pay full attention. And I'm not saying that he ought to let them both go. I think both sides ought to be punished equally, except I don't think, and you can tell me if you believe differently, I don't think the new Democrat Attorney General of Oregon is going to do that. He's going to go after Republicans hard, and he's going to ignore the crimes of Democrats.
Well, certainly. I mean, our newspaper has never shied away from the deeply unethical activities of Shamia Fagan and the highly compromising activities that Lamota did regarding the governor and Val Hoyle. I have always felt like there should be a deeper investigation of that, and in particular, a criminal investigation that went further than the one against than Fagan did. I would not disagree with the need for that to. What's good for the goose is good for the gander.
Yep. Hey, by the way, I want to ask you to comment on something because you got a little item. Willenweg did. And what does it say about a city that just saw its signature downtown office tower sell for 1/9 of its value just a decade ago? And now the cops are telling the Central Library, where tens of millions of dollars have been invested to make a Central Library that's big and fancy and all that, install metal detectors, take out the benches, turn off the outside Wi-Fi, and basically button things down because they just had a shooting on the front steps of the library. What does that say about efforts to try to revive downtown Portland?
Well, it doesn't seem good, Lars. I mean, I wouldn't like say that it's a real big like banner day for Portland's downtown boosters.
No, and I'm kind of wondering, I'd love to talk to Keith Wilson about it, the mayor. He was on once, he promised to come back, he's never been willing to come back again, and I'd really like to know, how do you answer this stuff? You keep telling her, oh, you know, downtown's alive again, except the, you know, the office tower that sold for $9 million a floor just a decade ago and went on a fire sale for $1 million a floor, and you've still got a lot of criminal activity, drug activity, homeless activity, and now the downtown library is told to install metal detectors. It's not a good sign that things are going in the right direction.
You know, I would say that it is fair to say that we have not yet hit bottom.
Wow, there's more to go? Okay.
Things can always get worse. If there's one thing that you never go banco on in the city, it is the conviction that things can always get a little worse.
Unfortunately true. That is Aaron Mesh, the managing editor at Willamette Week. You can find the story about Don Powers. And by the way, Don Powers, chair of the 6th Congressional District Republicans, is invited on this program anytime he wants if he wants to explain where the more than $100,000 from that shindig back in January went. Did it go in his own pocket? Did it go to the debts he already had because of his failing business? And why didn't it go to the Republican Party as he promised? I'll get back to your phone calls and emails in a moment. And Washington State has become so dangerous, there's been a huge surge in pistol permits going into the hands of citizens. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
On Blue Sky at Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to have you with me. And this segment of the show is brought to you by 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense online, 540training.com. Now, Brian Koberger, this case makes me so angry because I think that we missed a real opportunity. Koberger, if you don't remember, is the man who murdered 4 Idaho college students. Now, that happened a couple of years ago, 2022. He has now admitted to murdering Madison Mogan, Kaylee Gonclaves, Zana Kernodal, and Ethan Chapin. Murdered them all November 13th, 2022, about 2.5 years ago. So he pleads out. Why did he plead out? For reasons, I think, that are still yet to be explained. The prosecutor, who had a great case against him, he had lost in front of the defense attorneys, kept asking the judge for various things to be left out of the trial. They lost and lost and lost. And yet, despite that, the prosecutor decided to give Koberger the gift of not pursuing the death penalty. So the guy pleads out, gets allegedly a life sentence, although we all know after yesterday's discussion, life sentences are not the life sentences you once heard about, where you get locked up in prison for the rest of your natural life and they take you out in a body bag. In fact, I suspect that in the years or decades ahead, we're going to see Brian Koberger come up. There's going to be a change in legislation. There'll be a change in the courts, and he will probably try to seek to get his freedom. I hope he never does. He has pleaded guilty to this crime. But the second crime is that having given him the freedom from the death penalty, did the prosecutor say, and your client is going to stand there and admit what he did in explicit terms and why he did it? Koberger today was given an opportunity. The judge gave him an opportunity to speak. And what was his response? I respectfully declined. Yet there were members of the families of the four murdered college students, one of them the sister of Kaylee Gonclaves. Take a listen to what she had to say to Brian Koberger.
No one is scared of you today. No one is intimidated by you. No one is impressed by you. No one thinks that you are important. You orchestrated this like you thought you were God. Now look at you, begging a courtroom for scraps. You spent months preparing, and still all it took was my sister in a sheath. You worked so hard to seem dangerous. But real control doesn't have to prove itself.
No, it doesn't. And she's right. And it was sad. I listened to most of the testimony of the family members who got up to speak, including fathers, including friends, including sisters, as you just heard. Brian Koberger should have been going to death row. And in Idaho, they actually still do execute criminals. They should in Oregon. It would be the people's choice if the people had a choice. The majority in Oregon and Washington support the death penalty. The elites in government have decided we're not going to give it to you. Second issue, and I brought this up a moment ago, Washington State has become a dangerous place. At least that's the way it's viewed by citizens. And let me give you one piece of proof. The Washington State Department of Licensing has seen a large surge, perhaps a record surge, in applications for concealed carry permits for firearms. Now, I already have a permit for Washington State. I've had it for about 30-some years. Well, at the end of June of this year, more than 700,000 Washington residents had an active concealed pistol license that allows you to carry concealed. That represents a month-over-month increase of 1,410 statewide. That is the one-month increase, the largest seen to date in the state of Washington. 1,400 people said, I'm not going to be protected by the police, nor by the courts, nor by the legislature, nor by the parole boards. I'm not getting protection from those people. I must have to protect myself. That's the bottom line message. And it says that in the first 6 months of this year, more than 8,700 people in the state of Washington have obtained a concealed carry permit. And frankly, I don't blame them. Dave Workman, who's editor-in-chief of thegunmag.com, and you hear him on this show from time to time, he says that's an indication to me that there's a lot of concern out there about personal safety. Now, this could change. I mean, you could have the judges in both Oregon and Washington decide when people commit crimes, we are going to send them to prison. The judges so far have refused. You could have legislatures like Oregon and Washington that could say, when you commit serious crimes, we will make sure that you see the full weight of the law and the full punishment from the law. Instead, we're seeing the reverse. Just yesterday, I was telling you about the case of a young man, a teenager, who said he aspired to become a Mexican cartel sniper, who showed up at a birthday party, murdered one teenager, very seriously wounded another teenager. She will survive. She will recover. But the other teenager is dead. And what did he say? Well, he was less than 1 month short of his 18th birthday. So he's a matter of days or a couple of weeks away from his 18th birthday. But because he was just barely under that edge, they put him in juvenile court to begin with. At the end, all of the headlines, if you looked at most of the news sites and you didn't listen to this show, you heard he's getting life in prison. Do you know what he's actually getting? He's getting 32 and a half years in prison, of which the law says he has to serve 15 before he comes up for parole. That means that since he is about 20 years old or so, and he has to serve at least 15 years, he may well walk out of prison well before his 40th birthday. If anybody considers that a life sentence in prison, please call me up and tell me why. Glad to get your calls and your emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The
The Lars Lumber.
Put a bit so.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. Did replacing idiotic Democrat-inspired laws and actually funding Washington State Police improve the crime rate in the Evergreen State? I thought I'd put that question to John Braun, who joins me now. John is a state senator and head of Washington State Senate GOP caucus. Senator, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on, Lars.
Sounds like it's actually making a difference when you get rid of the dumb laws and actually give the police some money. They can get some things done. And one of the places that's shown up like that is auto theft, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. It's actually, it's an unusual but nice feeling to see good policy, but put back in place in the state legislature. This one having to do with police being able to pursue criminals. Pretty common sense to the average person that when we have crime that police have to be able to pursue, and we do want them to be properly trained and know when it's safe and when it's not safe and not put other folks at risk. But the idea that the Democrats put forward now 3 or 4 years ago was that it was just unsafe. They should never pursue. And Washington State saw a huge increase in auto thefts. We were the worst in the country. It was a crisis, and Republicans kept at it. From the very beginning, we opposed their change, and we fought every year for 3 years until last year. We were finally, with the help of over 400,000 citizens across the state, passed an initiative to the legislature that put the common sense police pursuit law back in place. And as a result, today, our auto theft numbers have taken a nosedive. Now that police can truly engage and hold criminals responsible, no surprise, we get less crime. It's pretty straightforward. We should have more of that in Washington State.
Are your colleagues across the aisle, do you ever see the light bulb go on where they say, oh, you mean when we let the police chase criminals, the criminals don't do that crime as much anymore? Or does the light bulb stay off?
Well, I think for some of them it does. And some of them we disagree on lots of policy, but they're not dumb. They get that what they did was wrong-headed, and some of them even helped us put right policy back in place. But there's a core who they continue to be intent on removing any possible consequences for crime. And the result is predictable. If there's no consequences when you don't follow the rules, people won't follow the rules. And if we want our state to flourish, we got to have a rules-based society.
So what do we have to do next, and what else has to get changed to continue this? Because I've got the same frustration with Oregon that I do with Washington State. Both states have police have been told not to do their job. Many times it's politicians that tell them to do that, whether it's the legislature or their city council or county commission. And then you've got sheriffs who are being told not to do their jobs. And when the sheriff bucks too many times, counties like King County say, well, then we'll make the sheriff appointed. The sheriff will work for us instead of the taxpayers. And you've got lawmakers who don't want to, not you, but the others who don't want to make, tough on crime kind of penalties. And you've got judges who seem to want to let criminals go more than they want to see them locked up.
It's all accurate. I mean, what we can't do is rest on our laurels. This is not going away. There's a small group who every year come out with new legislation to make it easy for criminals. We have to continue to push back as Republicans. We have to make the case. And if we do, at least in the last couple of years, we've been successful in getting some Democrats to stick with us, either to stop really bad bills that reduce penalties for crime or help us push forward bills that help us enforce the rules. I think the real challenge right now, beyond making sure we don't do anything anymore, take stupid legislation, is making sure prosecutors actually prosecute, judges actually carry out the sentences as required by law. And that's going to take more involvement by people making sure we have the right people in the prosecutor offices and the right people in our legal system, simply enforcing the law. This isn't partisan at all. You know, if they don't like the law, sure, try and change it. But if it's a law, we should uphold it. We should make sure people adhere to the law, and if they don't, there should become some consequences commensurate with the nature of the crime.
Well, what do we do about the judges? And I'm thinking about one in particular. Name is not in front of me. I think it's Vadi, but it's a judge in Seattle, and the prosecutor's office, Ann Davison's office, and we'd love to get her on the show one of these days, but she's apparently been affidaviting this judge, saying we don't want this judge on any of our cases, because apparently the judge is one of those restorative justice types who says, no, I don't want to punish criminals. We're going to have restorative justice, which is hocus pocus, and it doesn't work. And so she got affidavited off the cases. Well, then the judges now started to attack the prosecutor, Davison, saying she's angry that she's not getting these cases so she can let the criminals go. How do we fix that problem?
Well, first of all, Ann Davison is just doing her job. Her job is to enforce the law, to prosecute when people break the law. That's what the voters hired her to do. That's what she's doing. So good for her. I think she's doing the right thing. And yeah, we have judges, particularly in Lewis County, but in other parts of the state as well, who don't sit impartially from the bench. They have a partisan view, and they enact it from the bench. And ultimately, that's going to come down to all these judges are elected, and there's a path for people to say, no, we insist on a rules based society, and we hire we elect judges to make those, sometimes difficult but necessary decisions to make sure people know there's consequences of the law. So it's the same thing. I mean, we citizens of the state of Washington, we get the government we deserve, but we get a choice. It's the great thing about our country and our states is we get to decide. If we're not getting what we want, we get a choice at some future point. And we got to make sure we're choosing with an eye towards enforcing and upholding the law and making sure there's standards. And here's the thing: you got to recognize when we do that, people are less likely to break the law, more likely to commit their energies to more productive enterprises that will be better for them and better for society long term.
Let me ask you one last thing. I led off today talking about Lake Washington School District in Kirkland, and you got this high school, Juanita High School, and they were apparently employing an illegal alien who's got an asylum claim that's pending, but I would guess is probably going to be denied. He was picked up for deportation about 2 weeks ago. And the whole school community seems to be saying, oh, bring him back. We love him. I don't understand the reaction that when you find out this guy is apparently wanted by the police in Brazil for accusations of theft. We have no more details on it than that. And ICE picked him up. And they're preparing to deport him. And yet you're hearing the community not say, oh my God, thank God you got, an accused criminal from Brazil who's on a sketchy legal basis, even being in the United States, a visa overstay, and then a claim of asylum. And the community stands up to defend the wanted guy from Brazil.
Yeah, I suspect that's not, when you say the community stands up, I suspect that's a few very vocal, loud activists that are defending it. And what's frustrating is it goes back to what I said earlier. Look, we have federal immigration laws.
Yep.
They were put in place under our system of government. They should be enforced. They should be enforced, impartially. They should be enforced compassionately, I suppose. But they should be enforced.
Absolutely right. That's Senator John Braun, who is a state senator and the head of Washington State Senate GOP caucus. Back in a moment, we're going to talk about the DEI fire chief who refused to send boats during those Texas floods. That's next.
Well,
if the winner...
The risks and rewards of remote work.
Where are you now?
I'm sitting in my office.
I doubt that.
Why would you doubt that?
If you were in your office right now, we'd be having this conversation face to face.
At least woke progressives won't stop you from listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. In a moment, I want to talk about a fire chief who knew that there was flooding going on, knew that lives were at stake, including the lives of small children, and he refused to send his trained swift boat rescue people. But let me get to that in just a moment. First, welcome to the program. If you want to join the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com, and naysayers always go to the head of the list. Let me start with Stephen. Hey, Stephen, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Yes, hi. I'm curious. What do you think it says about American society that our president is in cahoots with a child sex offender?
Okay, hold on. So you say our president is in cahoots. I assume you mean Jeffrey Epstein,
Was in cahoots, correct.
Can you tell me, I'm not being pedantic, what do you mean by in cahoots? The two knew each other and described each other as friends until about 2004. And then for the 15 years after that, they were on the outs with each other. I mean, sometimes friends, you know, fall out with each other, and these two fell out with each other and were not friends at that point. And then, you know, Trump ran for president and Epstein went on about his perverted ways and was convicted a few years after they fell out. Not a few years. They fell out in about 04, 05. Epstein was, he got the sweetheart deal on the first set of sex charges he finally got it in 2008. I think he was actually accused in 06. And so at the time he was accused of the sexual crimes, he and Donald Trump weren't having anything to do with each other, and they haven't since. So when you say in cahoots, tell me what you mean by in cahoots.
Well, we do know that he acknowledged in an interview in 2002, I believe it was with The Atlantic, that suggested that he knew that Jeffrey Epstein liked women much younger than he did, as he suggested.
And he did. He said that in 2002 when the two were still friends.
So
he
is
said
there a
he likes
our president
he,
the was quote aware what the Mr. quote Epstein was doing.
The quote is that he and Epstein would sometimes go to the same parties. Sometimes it was one of Trump's parties, and he said he likes women that are a lot younger than the women that I like. He didn't say children, and that was in 2002 when Epstein had not been convicted or even accused of anything. So when you say they were in...
Well, we do know that the span of crimes did begin in the 90s.
We know that because when he finally took the sweetheart deal, it erased a whole bunch of things that he had done for which he should have seen much more severe punishment, but he did not get more severe punishment, and nobody quite can tell you why. But you say they're in cahoots, or they were in cahoots till Epstein died.
I mean,
obviously,
he was friends
until about 20 years ago, Stephen. That's what you have to answer for me, is if the two of them had a falling out before he was convicted of any crimes, before he was accused of any crimes, that's Epstein, then why would you say they're in cahoots when they had a falling out a little bit over 20 years ago?
Well, we do know he does know about Ghislaine Maxwell. He has wished her well. He has called her a friend in 2020.
It sounds like you're talking from talking points, Stephen. I swear you're talking from talking points because you know bits and pieces.
I'm not really talking from talking points, Lars. I actually have an independent mind.
I don't think that you know the entire story because you say they're in cahoots. Well, number one, Epstein's dead, has been for several years. Number two,
the president did anything nefarious on his part.
Okay, can you tell me this? Answer me this question. So when Donald Trump was running for president, they threw everything at him and the kitchen sink. After he
correct.
Finished his first term, they then for 4 years threw everything at him and the kitchen sink, including a last minute impeachment of Trump in the last 2 weeks of his presidency. Then they threw everything at him, including prosecutions in four different mm-hmm. places in America on sketchy stuff like, you put the records of the payments to Stormy Daniels in the accounting books in an incorrect fashion. So we're going to find you guilty of 34 felonies. If they had had something as salacious as Donald Trump is somehow involved in the sexual activities with children that Epstein, we know for a fact, was. Hold on. Will you please shut up for a second? I'm going to put him on hold for a moment. If they had that information, you've got it. So if you've got it and the DNC had it and Joe Biden had it, Barack Obama had it, tell me why they didn't use it before now.
Because we don't know about it. We didn't know about it. First off.
Well, hold on, Stephen. Let me tell you something. We knew that Epstein and Trump knew each other from the 90s. We know they bid on the same house that they were both trying to buy in Florida. They knew each other through social circus. We knew all that. And we knew all of that long before Trump ran for president. We knew all of that long before, and then Jeffrey Epstein was convicted of his crimes. So tell me what it is you think that Donald Trump did involving Jeffrey Epstein and children that implicates him.
Well, as I stated multiple times, I have not suggested that the President of the United States has done anything nefarious. What I have, the question was...
You said they were in cahoots. What does that mean to suggest?
I mean, they were friends. I'm not suggesting...
Until about 2004.
Criminal activity. I mean, we don't know what he engaged in.
Well, but if you said they were in cahoots, can you tell me about one joint... If somebody said Lars and his buddy Alfredo go hunting together, you'd say, that's right, they're kind of in cahoots. Tell me what it is you think they were jointly doing. If it wasn't sexual and it wasn't criminal, tell me what the thing is they did other than show up at some of the same social events.
Lars, we don't know what he did. I'm not suggesting, because you know, by saying they are in cahoots,
if somebody says you were in cahoots with a sexual criminal, I would say that you're suggesting that they were somewhere involved in that. What are you trying to suggest? Since I don't have my secret decoder ring to figure out what you're saying.
What I'm suggesting. My original question wasn't even suggesting that Donald Trump engaged in nefarious activity. I was suggesting whether or not what it says on American society that we've reached a point where he's friends with a child sex offender.
Well, here's the problem, Stephen. Have you ever had a friend who was later convicted of a crime?
No, I actually haven't.
You've never had anybody in your circle of friends or in your family or that you worked with who's ever been convicted of a crime?
No, I have not.
Not one. Wow. You live a pure life, because I'll tell you what, most of us have known somebody or a couple of people who then were later convicted of a crime, and we think, that was crazy. I never saw that in the person. But apparently you live a very pristine life. Because you don't know of anybody, not a family member, not a friend, not an associate from work, not a casual acquaintance who's ever been convicted of a crime. Good for you. Donald Trump knows a lot of people, and some of them have been convicted of crimes, including Jeffrey Epstein. But by the time Epstein was convicted in 2008, he and Donald Trump had been on the outs for a couple of years. But I appreciate the call. It's interesting. Let me just say quickly, the fire chief of Austin, Texas, Baker is his name, Joel Baker, on the day, 4th of July, that those horrible floods hit, and they hit especially hard for those kids in those summer camps, Christian summer camps, Joel Baker, his fire chief, had access to a swift water team to go out and rescue people in exactly that kind of situation. He refused to send them, apparently, because he was worried about the overtime money he'd have to pay. So even though he had the team, even though he had the tools, even though he had the resources, he refused to send help. And by the way, Chief Joel Baker is, well, he's a DEI hire. He was touted as the first African-American fire chief in Austin, and he promised that he would push DEI in his fire department.
The Lars Larson Show. Are you experiencing technical difficulties?
That electrician must be a Democrat.
No technical difficulties here. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get your phone calls, and I'll get to more of those in just a moment. As you know on this show, naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. And you can vote in our X poll. You find the X poll every day at Lars Larson Show and at larslarson.com. About a year ago, I was telling you as we headed up to the November election, and people said, well, how is Donald Trump going to deport all these people from America? He's promising the biggest deportation in American history. I said, well, he's going to do that, but I figure a bunch of people who are here illegally are going to self-deport. And now it appears that at least some states have come around and said, we're going to help them do that. And Anna Giaratelli joins me now, who's an investigative journalist with the Washington Examiner, covering homeland security, immigration, and the border. Three hot buttons for this day and age. Anna, welcome back.
Lars, thanks for having me.
So which state is doing it, and how are they making it happen? And could it be done by all the other states? Not the blue ones. They're not going to do it. But the red states could do more of this, couldn't they?
Yeah, this is really pretty unprecedented. This is Florida, which has been a close ally to the Trump administration this term in particular on the immigration issue as Trump looks to carry out his deportation operation. And what Florida's done, we were down, the Washington Examiner was down in Florida last week doing a ride along with Florida Highway Patrol. They shared with us that they're now allowing immigrants who are in the country illegally, who they pull over during traffic stops and turn over to Border Patrol, instead of taking those immigrants at Border Patrol station to Alligator Alcatraz or to an ICE detention site, they're saying to those illegal immigrants in custody, would you like to self-deport? The state of Florida will pay for your flight back to your home country, take you to Fort Lauderdale Airport tomorrow, and we'll give you that free option so that you can leave the country on your own accord and not be detained indefinitely and deported by ICE later on.
Boy, it sounds like an attractive offer. Are they getting takers?
They are getting takers. Yeah, the state, I spoke with two senior state officials as well as the top Border Patrol official in Florida, and all of them share that they are getting takers. Some concerns from the left, from immigrants' rights groups, are that, you know, people are being coerced into this. They don't have legal counsel. I mean, keep in mind, these are people who we were seeing were literally being pulled over for, you know, a broken taillight or making an illegal turn. And, you know, hours later, they're being asked to leave the country on their own accord. It's a pretty crazy thing that the state is doing. And the state's funding it, too. So these are, you know, Florida taxpayers who are going to be paying for this, but it's going to be astronomically cheaper for the state to do this. A ticket to Guatemala tomorrow out of Fort Lauderdale is about $50 U.S. dollars.
And it's so 50, a lot it's people 50 that. Bucks?
$50, is that $48 on Spirit Airlines. And then JetBlue had a flight for $78. Pretty far distance for very little money.
Can I get premium coach for another $10 on top of that?
Exactly. And you're going with the clothes on your back. So if you're flying Spirit Airlines, you know, you don't need a check-in bag or anything. It's very, very cheap. And the state is just getting started. They began this just a few weeks ago now.
Well, Anna, I'm talking to Anna Giaratelli, who's the Washington Examiner. So I'm curious about this. So are the groups that say this is coercion? I mean, is the coercion part that they're alleging that you're offering somebody, you can end up going into the hands of ICE, then you might go to Alligator Alcatraz, then they might deport you anyway, or we can give you a nice, pleasant ride to the airport and put you on a plane and get a soda pop on the way, and they look at that and say, I think I'll take option A instead of option B with Alligator Alcatraz. They're saying that's the coercive part of it.
Yeah, the coercive part is that normally when you go through a court proceeding, an immigration court, they take months to years. Most people I've seen at the border during the Biden administration and my 60 trips to the border were getting court dates 6-7 years in the future. And so rather than take your chances and wait to go to court, the only upside of that process is that you can get your affairs in order. You can figure out if you have a valid reason not to be deported. Maybe you have a U.S. citizen family member who's getting medical treatment here that you're supporting or something. Maybe you have a valid asylum claim. But the concern was that people who choose to self-deport don't have the ability to really think about it, to speak with a lawyer who might be able to advise them. And one of the things they shared is if you choose to self-deport and you've been in the country illegally, there's a 10-year minimum on when you're allowed to come back into the United States.
Uh-huh.
And the DHS has been messaging saying, we'll give you a way to come back, maybe. But they're not saying how long it's going to take. And immigration lawyers are saying it's going to be, this isn't you come back tomorrow, you get deported today. This is a long term. You might be able to come back one day.
And yet, Anna, I got to tell you something. I have no direct connection with family members who've, you know, come in and immigrated to the country. But I've talked to lots of callers to the show, and I've talked to a lot of attorneys. They tell me that the typical time. If you were sitting there in, you know, Mexico City or Germany or wherever you're sitting, and you say, I think I'll emigrate to America. You go to the American embassy and say, I'd like to emigrate. They say, okay, fill out all this stuff, pay a lawyer some money, and your wait time could be 2 to 5 years or even longer. So if we're telling people, well, if you self-deport, it may be 10 years, you're only a bit longer than if you had done it legally from the get-go, aren't you?
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, something else that one of the immigration lawyers I spoke with shared was that there's no line, per se, for people who choose to self-deport. Say you go back to Mexico and choose to, you know, come back legally. There's no new program or line for that individual to get in and say, okay, I'd like to come to the U.S. legally now. They're going to go back to the same towards the idea of a line. The paperwork that you have to fill out to get in for a visa that, you know, plenty of other countless people are already have submitted those applications and are in line for. So, like you said, yeah, now too, with people who are self-deporting, we don't know the full scope of how many are choosing to leave the country under Trump, but certainly a number of those people are going to want to come back legally. So you're probably going to see just an increase in general and the number of visa applications from, you know, certainly Latin America, where most immigrants in the U.S. who are in the country legally are from historically.
You know what, Anna? There's one thing, and I wish there were a way to get the metric, and maybe you've got a better idea than I do. But there was a phenomenon I was kind of anticipating, except I don't know how to measure it. And that is that as we've got, you know, 22 blue states or so, and about 28 red states, and the red states are especially, you know, saying we're going to help ICE get the job done, that I'm wondering how many illegals, you know, rather than self-deporting, are running off to the sanctuary states instead. Because I figure, you know, if the sanctuary states are telling the, you know, Trump administration, we're not going to help you. In fact, we're going to shelter them. Okay, you may get a flood of those people who say, I don't want to go back to El Salvador, Guatemala, or Honduras, or wherever, but maybe I can run to California, maybe I can run to New York, and I'm wondering if that's happening, and if anybody has a way to measure how much of it is happening.
Yeah, that would be, unfortunately, we can't measure that because we don't have the statistics for by cities and who's moving, and the census won't give us, you know, data for another, you know, number of years. Anecdotally, I can tell you, actually, based on facts, Texas and Florida, both red states with Republican governors, have some of the largest illegal immigrant populations. That includes cartel and gang members in the country. And so even though they are red states, Texas hasn't cracked down on cartels to the extent that you may expect they would. They certainly took a stronger approach during the Biden administration when the border was really seeing tons of people come over. Now that the border is very quiet, the focus is on the interior of the state, and that's where we've really seen Florida Governor Ron DeSantis really lead. He knows, he seems to know what he's doing interior-wise within the state, how to get...
Well, maybe that's what Texas has to do. Anna, thank you very much. That's Anna Giaratelli, who's an investigative journalist with the Washington Examiner. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Everyone's favorite color is gold.
I can proudly proclaim that the golden age of America is upon us.
Sit back and enjoy. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And this segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. I got a couple of naysayers, so I guess it's let's go to the one who's been waiting longer. John, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
Well, hello, Lars. I hope you can hear me all right.
If I couldn't, it wouldn't matter anyway. So what do we disagree about?
Well, I guess I don't have my magic decoder ring to understand what you're trying to say, but... how do you know that Epstein and Trump parted ways in, what did you say, 2004?
Yeah, because both of them said so. And statements made long before, about a decade before Trump would announce for president, they both indicated that they were on the outs.
That's how I know. Them.
Well, hold on. John, if I'm going to describe two people as being friends, and they tell me they're friends, I don't have another source for looking up whether or not two people are friends. If you knew two people, you say, do you know Lars over there? And you say, ah, Lars is my friend. We've been friends a long time. What other source are you going to go to determine if that's the truth or not? If suddenly one day you say, hey, you ought to ask your friend Lars about that, and he says, ah, Lars and I haven't spoken in 2 years. I don't really like the guy. Where should I go to double-check his assertion that they are no longer friends?
Okay, you trust them. Fair enough.
Well, hold on. It's not about trusting them. You're trying to extend this to I trust a convicted sex offender. No, I don't. But if Trump says the two-parted company, and they had had their differences over the years, if the two-parted company, before Trump ever ran for president, then give me the evidence that they were still buddies.
Let me point out two things.
No, John, I've answered your question. Now, you want to pose a challenge like that, saying they're buddies, you trust them when they say they're not. I'm going to say, show me something that indicated they were still associated with each other after they say they weren't.
Why was Trump on the list? Why was Trump on Epstein's list?
Because John.
That's a good reason.
Well, we're told that he's on the list, and did they go to the same parties for a period of time? Yes, they did. Did Epstein belong to Mar-a-Lago? Yes, they did. Did Trump say, yes, I flew on Epstein's plane a number of times, but never out to that island he owned, but only within the continental United States, and he was on the flight logs for those? That explains that answers your question, does it not?
Do you still believe in Santa Claus?
No, you know, I ask you a question. I do you the courtesy. If I ask you a question and you don't want to talk, then that's fine. I'll say goodbye. Thank you for a naysayer. Do better next time. Let's go to JC, who's also a naysayer. Hey, JC, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Yes, the self-deportation. The person you interviewed from Florida, one of the key components that she forgot to mention was the incentive, which was presented by that Pee Wee Herman child molesting looking guy, in my opinion. I think his name was Stephen Miller. You know, there is no, you know what I'm talking about.
You're talking about Stephen Miller, the executive assistant to President Trump?
If that's what he is, yes.
He's bald, so he looks like Pee Wee Herman? I don't know, but okay, whatever your interpretation is, go ahead. I'm not sure what you're asking.
A lot of people in the
JC, you're wasting our time. What do we disagree about?
Well, the $1,000, if that...
What $1,000?
Pee Wee Herman looking...
What $1,000?
Pee Wee Herman child... They had
made the offer that if people would self-deport, they'd give him some money to relocate. So what?
He said a million people have already taken that offer. You know how much that money that is, Lars? 1,000 times a million? I know you can do math. You went to high school. I know you didn't finish college. You know how much that is?
Yeah.
That's a lot of money. Let's see the receipts and see who's lying.
Except that, JC,
because you're
do you not believe the number?
That.
Do you not believe the number?
No. I don't see no receipts anywhere. Just because some child molesting looking guy, in my opinion, says that, I don't trust.
Well, hold on. You actually decide that people look like child molesters based on what they look like?
And how they act.
Well, hold on a second. By all accounts, do you know who Ted Bundy was?
You don't have to change the subject.
I'm going to ask you a question, and you're going to answer it. Do you know who Ted Bundy was?
Yes.
Okay, one of the worst mass murderers in America. And he was, by all accounts, a charming, good-looking law school student. But you're apparently a person who decides that somebody must be a criminal because of looks. And I don't know how that gets us ahead in the conversation. If you don't like Stephen Miller, say you don't like him. If you don't like him and you say you don't like him, then tell me why you don't like him. Do you not like him because he's not good-looking? Okay, I don't go around judging the looks of men. JC, maybe you do. But I don't understand what that has to do with the conversation. And if the U.S. government says illegal aliens are costing us many thousands of dollars per illegal alien per month, and you could get rid of them for a $1,000 incentive to provide the relocation costs, I would call that a cheap deal. If you say an illegal alien who's signing up for all the social welfare benefits that America provides and taking a job from an American citizen and all the rest of that, you can get rid of that person for $1,000. That is cheap on any day of the week. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
All day, find your...
Ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network. I don't ever insist that my guests on this show adopt my point of view or even my opinions on subjects, but we'll see if Daniel Bonham agrees with me. I think that Kabuki Tina Kotek, who is the governor of Oregon, and she's running a piece of theater on the entire state, more than 4 million people, by playing a little game. She lets the legislature adjourn. They have considered a $15 billion tax hike, and even the supermajority Democrats said no to that. And then they considered a $2 billion cut-down tax increase, and the Democrats said, no, we're not even voting for that, even though they had enough votes to actually pass it had they wanted to. So then Kotek lets a couple of weeks go by, and in the meantime, she has state agencies announcing the sky is falling, snow will not be plowed, potholes will not be filled. I mean, terrible things will happen. Puppies and kittens and the humanity. And now all of a sudden she says, we're going to have a special session about almost 6 weeks from now. And we're going to have it heading into a big holiday weekend on Friday. So most people won't be paying attention. And then we'll get the tax increase we actually wanted. I think this is all theater, including the threatened layoffs of hundreds of people. Notice no white collar people, just blue collar people. Now I'm going to go to Senator Daniel Bonham, who joins me now, Oregon Senate Republican leader. Senator, welcome back to the program. And I don't ask you to endorse any of those ideas, but I want your unvarnished opinion of what Tina Kotek is doing.
I mean, you don't even need me, Lars. You just nailed it.
I do. But see, people, when they hear it from you, they're going to believe it more than when they hear it from me. I just swear that she said, let's just cook this whole thing up. Way back when, Daniel, I had a friend of mine say, oh, that's the Close the Washington Monument School of Government. I said, what's that? He said, well, when the Congress wants to pass a tax increase, they tell the National Park Service people to close the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, the Jefferson Memorial. And then when the tourists walk up, you say, I'm sorry, the government's out of money. The memorial is closed today, which doesn't really even take staff, might take maintenance. And he said, they do that? He goes, oh, yeah, they do it all the time. Is that what Kotek is doing right now?
The only unique thing about this session, this moment in time, is that we're doing this with ODOT and not school districts. I mean, normally this is education funding, right? Like, normally we hold the kids hostage. And since I've known Tina, I've been down there now since November of 17 when I was appointed. Every interaction we've had with her over cap and trade, any other big fight that we've had, she takes hostages and then she shoots the hostage. And so that's what she's doing right now. I mean, she is holding ODOT hostage. She spent hundreds of millions of dollars on housing affordability that's produced no affordable housing. It is special interest friends of hers just getting paid off after payoff, you know, labor unions, special interest. That's, she's spending the general fund money the way she wants to, and then she's turning around to you after putting forward an executive order, that project labor agreement that we know for a fact here in Oregon has already driven up the cost of the one project that went through with that, the Newburgh-Dundee bypass, 20%. nationwide. You'll hear from think tanks. They all say it's 20%. They'll say it's 30% on housing. So project labor agreements, which require contractors to join into labor union agreements, drive up costs 20 to 30%. And she's got that out there as an executive order, driving up costs while she's turning around and telling you, hey, we may have a $140 billion budget, which is, you know, absurdly outsized for the size of our state, whether it's GDP or population or any other metric that you're looking at. We spend more money than any other state per capita, and yet we don't have enough for core function of government. So I've driven up the cost, I've misspent, misallocated resources, and at the end of the day, the only thing that can save us now, if we're going to save these poor ODOT employees from unemployment, is for you to pay more at the gas tank.
And by the way, Senator, you can add one more to that list on the Newburgh-Dundee bypass. How about the homeless shelter that a charity group wanted to build in Astoria? And they were told, I mean, this is a private organization. Yeah. They were told, you have to do this as well. And they said, hold on, that's going to put the cost out of reach. The project won't happen then. And they said, yeah, too bad. Exactly. If you can't do it the union way, then you can't do it at all. So what I'm curious about now is, in following the legislature, I've never actually covered it day to day, but in following it, there seems to be a pattern that you don't bring anything to a vote until you're fairly sure that you know what the outcome of the vote is going to be, yes or no. And so in this case, she's announcing a special session, but she doesn't have a deal cut, does she?
No, she doesn't. I'll tell you straight up, we got on the phone with the two minority leaders and the governor the other day, and it was Monday night, and she said, hey, I've got a couple dates proposed, and I'm hoping you can tell me availability of your caucus. And the first one was like next week. And I said, well, there's no way we can be there next week. Like, I still have people out of the country. I have people I haven't even talked to since session has ended. Like, normally we take July off. People leave, they go back to work. We're citizen legislators. There are very few of us that don't have some other means of income or some other job or employment or obligation. And so people are out doing their thing. And so I said, we definitely can't do next week. And she said, the other one's August 29th, Labor Day weekend. And I thought, okay, well, let me get with my caucus. Christine Drazen said the same thing. I haven't even talked to my caucus. Like, I don't know if I've got anybody available. But we asked that question, Lars. We said, so you must have 36 votes in the House and 18 in the Senate without us, and all you need us for is quorum. Like, that must be the only thing you're asking for. And she said, yes, that she had the votes. Now,
Hold on, Senator.
I talked to my Democrat friends, and I don't believe that she has the votes.
Well, but then tell me this. What she's planning to do is cut the public out of this. Am I right? Because if she's got the votes for whatever deal she's cooked up, and she says, I've got my caucus, they'll all vote for it, we're going to hold it going into a holiday weekend, we're going to keep 5 weeks of silence so that the public never knows what's being considered, and then during a long holiday weekend, they'll just pass it when nobody's watching, and by the time people come back on Monday or Tuesday of the following week, they'll say, yep, the deal got done. You go, what was in the deal? Oh, well, you can tell
hold on,
we can tell you
about it
now.
It gets better, though, Lars, because today she rolled out. She had a big meeting. She had her transportation people come and tell us, you know, what to look for in this short special session that we're going to have and kind of what the framework might be. And Democrats were saying, when do we actually get to see something in writing? When do we actually get to see the language? The language matters. The nuance of how you write and craft these policies matter. Like, you can come in and say, we're going to balance the highway cost allocation study, which is a constitutional obligation. In Oregon, we say that the light vehicles and the heavy trucks have to be in balance. You can't burden one of those sets of drivers more than the other. And so we've been out of balance for about 4 years now, to the tune of $600 million. The truckers are now suing the state. They're in the midst of litigation over this because we have been out of balance. We know we're out of balance. We have tried as Republicans to call for a special session. Yep. We have drafted language to try and solve this. Democrats continue to ignore us. And so they're saying, well, we've got that resolved, is what they said on the phone call today. And so, of course, people in the legislature that are not idiots, that have been paying attention to this stuff, are saying, well, can we see how you've solved it?
And she's not going to tell the public about it. That's Senator Daniel Bonham. Senator, thank you very much. I appreciate the time. I know we'll be talking over the next few weeks. Thank you. Hey, are you... If...
Lars Daily question to all the Dems in our government.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Now, the one with the brain, Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. If you happen to be a naysayer, as you notice, we've had some fun naysayers so far today. I'm glad to take your call at 866-439-5277. Answer our X poll. The daily poll question can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. On that note, let's go first to Ron. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, what's on my mind is, Lars, I'm glad I listened to your show because I just listened to some news that just contradicted the news that the Democrat useful idiots were just reporting on your show.
Really? Well, what was that?
Yeah. Well, you had those people on there telling you that the Justice Department told Trump that his name is on the list. I found out that that's not at all what they said.
Nope.
They said that there was unverified allegations that his name was on the list. And we've been down this road before with the P-tapes and Russia, Russia, Russia. Once again, and apparently it looks to me like the Wall Street Journal put this out, and the Democrats have it on all their X accounts. So it's really amazing that the... Wall Street Journal can't get the news right.
Well, and let me tell you this, Ron. I gave the caller what I thought was a legitimate answer. If you say, why, his, you know, Trump's name is on Epstein's list. Well, what does that mean? I mean, we know that Bill Gates of Microsoft was a visitor to Jeffrey Epstein's house and had dinner. We have no indication whatsoever that Gates ever did anything by going out to Sex Island or flying on the Lolita Express airplane or anything like that. There were probably thousands, maybe even tens of thousands of people who had taken flights on his airplane, who had been at his house, who'd done all these things and had no connection to illegal activity at all. And I remember when Musk first made the allegation, well, your name is on Epstein's list. Well, what does that mean? Because it sounds as though the fact that they've been able to keep this quiet after Epstein's first conviction, after his, you know, his pending trial before he died, and I think he died by being murdered, after Ghislaine Maxwell's trial, when you said, okay, so you're on his list, what does that mean? You know, it doesn't mean anything, because if you say the two of them knew each other for about 15 years and were apparently friends by their own account, and then they had a falling out several years before Epstein was convicted. So even if Trump was on a guest list or a flight list because he was on the airplane, doesn't say that he was doing anything untoward. In fact, you know, since Gates is more toward the left side of American politics, sometimes hard left side of politics, the fact that he had been at Epstein's house, does that indict him as a sexual criminal? It doesn't. I don't see any evidence of it. And I'm not a defender of Bill Gates. So, you know, I know they're trying to connect it to Trump in some way. But, Ron, all you have to do is ask yourself, how much have the Democrats done to be able to try and tar and feather Donald Trump over the last 10 years? Everything they could possibly throw, including the kitchen sink, got thrown at Trump. Does anybody seriously suggest that the Democrats, having access to all this data for all these years, I mean, all this information about Epstein was in the hands of the DOJ and in the hands of the FBI, and that they had all this info and they could have brought up really salacious criminal activities of Donald Trump, and they just held back on doing it? Does anybody believe that?
Well, I certainly don't. And if anybody was really so concerned about this, they would be talking to the Southern District of New York, because the courts there apparently have all the information all put away on a plea deal with Maxwell. So
yep.
It seems to me that if you're going to scream and yell about trying to get to the bottom of this, maybe you should start with Chuck Schumer.
Well, and maybe you should, but I'll tell you something else that seems strange. I mean, I was like the Sherlock Holmes saying, the dog that didn't bark. So when Ghislaine Maxwell was on trial as the human trafficker for Jeffrey Epstein after Epstein died, and you think, if there was ever a time when you could trade information about other people who got sexual favors with children because of Jeffrey Epstein, it would be during Ghislaine Maxwell's trial. Because wouldn't that have been the time for her to go to the prosecutors or have her lawyers go to the prosecutors and say, look, my client knows all these things about all these people who weren't involved in trafficking. They were involved in sexual crimes against children. We'd like to trade that information for a much lighter sentence. She got, I think, 20 years. And it struck me that if she had anything that was of substance to say about who Jeffrey Epstein's friends were who got, you know, sex with children, that would be the time to say it so you don't get a 20-year stint in federal prison, which usually ends up only being shortened to about 18 if you behave yourself. So wouldn't she have traded that information a few years ago when she was convicted?
One would assume, but you know what? The Democrats are like a dark casino in an alley. Anytime they want to make something happen, they'll pay people off. And it wouldn't surprise me a bit if some Democrats went up in there and made some deal with her, said, hey, what, just say this and we'll just send you, I don't know, cigarettes. You can see how this could play out.
I don't know. If the information was about highly placed political figures and highly placed financial figures in America or maybe in the world, that information would be worth more than a carton of cigarettes at the federal pen. I would think it'd be worth years off your sentence. But Ron, I appreciate the call. I do want to play one soundbite for you, though, and that's Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence. Yesterday, they rolled out a lot of information that indicated that President Obama was in on and helped assist the Russia hoax with the intent of changing the outcome of the 2016 election. And then Obama came out and said, no, that's ridiculous. Well, Gabbard came out again today and described more of what they had their hands on.
John Brennan, who was CIA director at the time, and the intelligence community intentionally suppressed intelligence that showed Putin was saving the most damaging material that he had in his possession about Hillary Clinton until after her potential and likely victory. The report goes into great detail about the information that Russia and Putin had on Hillary Clinton, which included possible criminal acts like secret meetings with multiple named U.S. religious organizations in which State Department officials offered, in exchange for supporting Secretary Clinton's campaign for the presidency, significant increases in financing from the State Department.
Now, imagine this. You've got the Obama administration trying to get Hillary Clinton across the finish line. By all accounts, we're now finding out that apparently she was under heavy tranquilizers during her campaign, that she had anger outbursts, that she was unpredictable, all these other crazy things about Hillary Clinton, most of which I believe. And then I want you to take yourself back to one of the 9/11 memorial ceremonies in New York City. Do you remember when Hillary Clinton was leaving that memorial ceremony? And she was heading back to the van, which was right parked on the street close by. And they literally had to pick her up physically because she was just about to collapse as she tried to get into a van. She was apparently incapacitated by something. We still don't know what. But if you think Obama had a political dog in the fight, he wanted Hillary Clinton to win, not because I think he liked Hillary Clinton. I don't think Barack Obama could use Hillary Clinton for anything. But I think what he wanted was he wanted her to beat Donald Trump. And he was going to use the FBI and the CIA and every other apparatus of government to try to get her across the finish line. It did not work, and thank God, because it meant that Donald Trump could save America. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
Lars Larson Show. Lars finally agree with Chuck Schumer?
Of course there's some wasteful spending, but you don't use a meat axe and cut everything.
Pass out the chainsaws and welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. And I got
my chainsaw. Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I want to talk to you about home ownership and whether or not real estate investors are wrecking the American dream. Ty Lasseter joins me now, who's CEO of Lasseter Capital. Ty, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's always great to be on here, Lars.
thank you very much for coming on. So tell me this. There is a belief that there are people out there overbidding marketplaces and buying houses for greater than market value and then somehow benefiting from that. Although I'm not a big real estate investor. I have a house that I live in. Did I pay as little for it as possible? Absolutely. Would I say, no, it'd be a better idea if I'd overpaid by 20%. I think I'd be just sinking myself into red ink. I'm not sure how they think that scheme is working to artificially boost the value of other properties and lock people out of the marketplace. Am I understanding the controversy right?
Well, yeah, that's completely preposterous that they would believe that that's what is actually going on. I mean, is the housing market across the United States priced out of the ability for homeowners and individuals to really afford homes at this point? No, they're not. But that's not why. It's a supply and demand issue at the end of the day. We've got significant demand on affordable housing right now that is outpacing supply by about 33%. And it's really a number of factors that are going into that. It's income across the United States. It's inflation and the cost of goods and materials. But at the end of the day, investors are not going to overpay for an asset because they're not going to make a return on the investment. So it doesn't matter if one investor wants to overpay for an asset to artificially inflate the values around them, great. But how do they afford that asset? They don't at that point because rent still is capped. Not from a mandate perspective, but from an affordability perspective. So if I own a bunch of real estate. But if I overpay for that real estate and I use debt or even with my money, I want a certain return on my money that's in it. And renters can't afford rent that justifies the return. Well, then I've made a poor investment. And like you said, we're in the red the whole time.
I mean, because so you could walk in, Ty, you could walk in and buy a $600,000 or $1 million house. You say to make that pencil, I've got to rent it for, I don't know what the number would be, how much per month, because I've got this much in the payment. I've got this much in maintenance and other costs, and I've got to recover this month. Then you go out and put the house up for rent at that number. And everybody looks at it and says, yeah, I can rent the same house down the street for $500 less. I'm not going to rent from you. Right.
Yeah, that's absolutely how it's going to work. I mean, at $1 million, I'm going to want to get at least $7,000 a month, at least. And so if they could go down, or, well, let's put it this way, $1 million house that's truly worth $1 million, I'm going to want $7,000 a month. If we bump that up to, let's say I overpaid by 20% to $1.2 million, and I'm looking for rent at that point, I'm going to need at least $8,500 to make that overpayment justified. Well, now I'm $1,500 in rent above market, and I'm not going to get a tenant because at the end of the day, it's still $1 million house. So a tenant's not going to pay rent in $1 million house for the value of a $1.2 million house. They're just not going to.
No. And so where does all this stuff, and I guess in terms of affordability, you've got supply, you've also got interest rates. Even the family that's in a position to buy a house right now at 6.5%, isn't that about where it is now?
Yeah, it's right at 6.5%.
Which means if it dropped to 4, I mean, when Biden came in, I think the lowest at that point was 2.5. But if it dropped to 4.5, all of a sudden a lot of houses would be affordable to a lot more people, wouldn't they?
Oh, absolutely. A 1.5 to 2 point swing is going to significantly change the dynamic. And that swing is not going to immediately turn into an increase in price of the home, as many people have said. There's still a market rate for homes right now. And what we've got at this point, and in fact, the thought that is even, you know, flashing around that people are overpaying for properties. Well, point in hand is right now in southwestern Florida, there's over 500,000 houses on the market right now to choose from. And really from the panhandle all the way down to the south of Florida. And that's because people are trying to sell a home and there's no buyers in the marketplace. Well, if people were overpaying and if it was investors that were overpaying, they would be jumping all over that opportunity. But at the end of the day, they're not. And so are investors buying up properties? Yes, absolutely. That's always been the case. 70% of the real estate in America has always been owned by 10% of Americans. That's just how it is. But that's not changing, and they're not overpaying for those assets. What they're actually doing is creating affordability for people who need a house. So for us, for example, when I'm buying an asset, I'm paying actually below market value if I can, so that I can turn around and rent and hit an affordable rent for a tenant who can afford to pay the payment on the house, but they can't afford the down payment and the cost that it takes to buy a house right now.
Yep.
And so it's a win-win situation.
You know, I want to throw a crazy idea at you, and you tell me what you think. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and FHA, those are the three big mortgage industry lenders, and they're federal agencies, are they not? Or are they private?
They're somewhat private. They're backed by federal funding.
Okay, so Austin, Texas, and San Antonio both saw a giant boom in building, and they got enough supply up that prices actually went down a bit because they changed the rules, the government rules that make it hard to build. If you want to get communities to do that around America, it's up to the state and local governments to do it or not do it, and a lot of them aren't doing it because they're kind of greedy. They want all those fees. L.A. wants something like a quarter of the cost of the house in government permits. What if Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, as somewhat government agencies, said, hey, tell you what, if you're willing to change your rules and make it easier to build in your area, we'll give you a half a point lower rate. And for those states that decide to stick with the higher cost of building, like California, we're going to give you a half point higher. It'll be revenue neutral to the federal government, and the states that do the right thing will get a reward, and the states that don't will get the stick.
Oh, that would be huge, and it would actually help some of those states, because Texas has done something similar to that from a property tax perspective. And so if there was a number of states that participated in that, it's why Texas has not seen the housing crisis impact as badly as some states do in 08. And again, last year, because, I mean, obviously here in the state of Texas and in Florida, we have property taxes. And what oftentimes happens is when we've got a supply and demand issue, local jurisdictions will offer property tax incentives for developers to build. And typically that comes in the form of what's called a pilot program, or payment in lieu of taxes. And that payment is a very discounted payment. As long as you supply affordable housing to a market that needs affordable housing.
And sounds reasonable to me. That's Ty Lasseter. Ty, I got to sign it off. That's Ty Lasseter, CEO of Lasseter Capital, and we will have him back. We've got to get this problem fixed. We got to get America building houses, providing jobs for all those people building them in the private marketplace, and supply what Americans need. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Go to the head of the line at the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday, and always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. This segment of the show is brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialist, Oregon Medical Centers. And our X poll today, should the government check so-called personal data submitted to get food stamps and other kinds of welfare to confirm that the recipients are actually eligible? Well, there are a lot of people getting their, you know, their knickers in a twist over the fact fact that the U.S. Department of Agriculture wants state agencies that administer food stamps, official name Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program or SNAP program, to turn over personal information. That means names, addresses, dates of birth, and social security numbers of people who get SNAP or food stamp benefits. Well, there are people just pitching a fit about this. That's my personal info. Guess what happens to your personal info when you go to a government agency and you say, I am eligible for that government benefit and I'd like to get it. And they say, well, you need to tell us who you are. You need to tell us about your income. You need to tell us about your date of birth. You need to tell us your social security number. And you say, that's my personal info. I'm not giving it up. Then you don't get your food stamps. Too bad. The information you have handed over in exchange for a benefit. Let's go to Michael. Hey, Michael, thanks for the call on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, I'm a first-time caller, everyday listener.
Thank you.
This old Tina Kotek special session is got me feeling the burden of taxation without no representation down in Cape Falls, Southern Oregon. It's a red county, you know. And
I used to live there. I know it well.
Nice. So, what is the procedure about getting some sort of representation or getting some sort of demand that
Michael, technically, you are represented by a state representative who's down there. You say, yeah, but we got one and Portland has 20 of them. You're right.
Exactly.
But here's the problem, Michael. Take it to a much smaller scale. You're in a family of 10. You like to go hunting. The rest of the family wants to go to the beach, and you take a family vote on it. 8 members of your family vote to go to the beach. You vote. You and one other person in your family vote to go hunting. Where are you going for vacation? You're going to the beach.
Right?
And you say, but I'm not represented. Yes, you are. You and the other person who want to go hunting got represented, and you're 2 votes, and we're 8 votes. And I hate to say it, but if you live in a very low population part of the state, and you say, but I want the same, you know, throw weight that Multnomah County has with 800,000 people, or Washington County with about 700,000 people, or Clackamas County with 600,000. I'd like Klamath Falls with, what's Cave Falls now? Is about 30 or 40,000 people?
Yeah, somewhere around there.
Okay, so you're saying we want to have the same amount of poll at the legislature with 40,000 people that the Tri-County area has with 2 million. Is that going to work out in your favor?
No, it's not.
It's not, because you don't have the votes. Now, how can you get representation? You got Republicans who can say to Tina Kotek, if you're throwing another giant tax package at us, we're just not going to show up. And that means your Democrats can't even vote on it. And I hope that's what they do. I hope what they do is say, if this is not a package that our constituents want passed, do you know they're required to show up for the regular session by law, but they're not required to show up for a special session? Did you know that?
I didn't know that. That's,
yeah, well, and you know what?
That eases my mind a little bit better.
Do you know what a quorum is? A quorum says if you're on, say, a school board, and you and your buddy are on the school board, and you're both conservative, but the other 5 members of the school board are a bunch of freaking liberals, right? So the freaking liberals, so you and your buddy show up at the meeting room one day, and the rest of the folks aren't there, and there's just 2 of you. You say, why don't we vote to fix all the things in the schools? You can't, because you don't have a quorum. In most legislative bodies, you have to have half the people there to cast a vote. Otherwise, you and your buddy could show up and just say, we're going to change all the things in the school district while the other 5 members of the school board aren't there. You don't get to do that. Yeah. You have to have a quorum. Well, the Democrats need a quorum, too. They have a supermajority. They got all the votes, but they don't have a quorum if the Republicans don't show up. Does that make sense?
That makes perfectly good sense.
And you don't want it to go the other way. You don't want to get rid of quorum rules, because then, two people could show up at the legislature and vote something through while the other members of the House or Senate are not there. And you don't want that to happen either. Michael, I think things are going to be okay. We'll get this taken care of. Let me go to Jake. Hey, Jake, welcome to the program.
Hey, Lars, I had a question for your previous caller, but maybe you can answer it. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they're government agencies?
They're kind of a weird animal in between. They're called a GSE, which is government-sponsored entity. So they were chartered by the federal government to go out and buy up packages of loans. So they, and in 08, they were actually put under a conservatorship, kind of like Britney Spears was, because 08, the whole world fell off a cliff. And, but they are a government-sponsored entity that operates under the supervision of a federal government agency. So they're a little bit of both animals. So they're a heffalump.
Kind of like the VA loan and the FHA loan. It's
the same kind of
animal.
Yeah, it's a weird mix of private and public. All I'm suggesting is if the federal government wanted cities to ease and counties and states to ease up on the building rules, they could just say the favorable mortgage rates go to the places with reasonable rules for building, which would not include Los Angeles. And the ones that don't have, you know, the ones that don't have the good rules, you get the higher rate. The ones with the good rules get the lower rate, and things get changed.
The Lars Larson.